This is Culturetopia, a look back at the week's best arts reporting from National Public Radio. I'm Netta Ulibi, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Linda Holmes, editor of NPR's arts and entertainment blog, Monkey See.
Every week, we bring you the best cultural coverage from books and music to movies, television, and everything in between.
And you can find links to all the stories we feature each week at npr.org/culturetopia.
This week,
writer-director Nora Ephron talks about Julie and Julia.
And we hear music from Senegalese rapper Didier Awadi.
And NPR's Lynn Neary looks into the world of ghostwriting. But first,
Bueller. The movie Ferris Bueller's Day Off is a classic teenage wish-fulfillment fantasy. It was directed by John Hughes, who died last week at the age of 59. Linda, last week you wrote a blog post about your five favorite film moments from Hughes' work. Can we recall?
Absolutely. The moments that I chose to write about, I tried really hard to use ones that sort of I was able to call to mind, as opposed to, you know, going through and trying to research the ones that were the most important. And I found that the first thing that I thought of was a moment in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. That's early in the movie when Ferris's parents have just left, and he is still enjoying sort of the rush of having the day away from school. And one of the things that he finds himself doing is sitting in his bedroom, honking away on a clarinet very incompetently.
Never had one lesson.
The reason why I've always really liked that moment is that it's so important in that movie that he not be just a brat. And I think because he's so popular and well-liked, if he just seemed to be staying home because he didn't want to be at school, he would just be a brat. But because he has all these plans, he just wants to have a genuinely good time and try things and, you know, be out in the world and have adventures and honk away badly on the clarinet. And I've always felt like those kinds of moments in that movie really set the tone for the idea that he has these sort of big dreams about his day away from school as opposed to just ditching. So that was the first one that I talked about, and then there are a few more.
You can read the full post at npr.org/monkeysee.
What is it that you really like to do?
Eat.
I like to do.
I know. And we are so good at it. Look at you. Now,
growing
how good you
in
are.
Front of you.
That's Meryl Streep, who plays Julia Child in the new movie Julie and Julia. Julie, played by Amy Adams, is a struggling young office worker who decides to cook her way through mastering the art of French cooking and blog about it. That blog became a book, and now writer and director Nora Ephron has woven both women's stories into a movie. Ephron spoke with Linda Wertheimer about the movie, and in this clip we hear her talk about one of Julia Child's signature dishes, bœuf bourguignon.
You had to have a copy of Mastering the Art of French Cooking. It was part of your equipment as an adult, and you had to make bœuf bourguignon for your friends. So everyone did.
That being the case, maybe you should have released the movie a little later in the year.
I know, because it's got a lot of stew in it. It would have been a good winter movie. It's true.
But the idea of Julia Child, I mean, is Julia Child and Mastering the Art of French Cooking being a part of your life, was, do you feel that you have some sort of a relationship with Julia Child that made you want to do the movie?
I actually think whenever you cook in some strange way, it's a form of time travel. When I used to cook from Julia's cookbook, I had long imaginary conversations with her. And I used to think maybe she would come to dinner, even though I had never met her and never did.
The character, as Meryl Streep plays her, is mostly a very jolly woman who's, you know, a very good-natured woman who's very funny. But Julia Child must have been, I never met her, but she must have been a ferocious intellect to do what she did, to organize that book as ferociously as she did, to explain it as clearly as she did.
Well, and I think she was a great teacher. I think that one of the things she did in a way that is interesting to me, because I sometimes watch some of these shows, things like Iron Chef, which, and I'm a good cook, and I look at something like Iron Chef and think it's a good thing I already know how to cook, because I would never think I could do it. if I watched these shows. She made you know you could do it. And you know, another thing that I was completely knocked out by when I did the research for this book is that the book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, was published when she was about to turn 50. And, you know, we think of Julia Child as someone who was famous from the time we were
aware of television.
Yes, aware of food. And it's so astonishing that she turned her life around as late as she did. She just didn't become herself till she was 50 years old.
It is remarkable. And the other thing, of course, the other part of the... There is a certain similarity, I suppose, in the two women that you make in the that you made the movie about, in that they're both obsessed people,
and they both want to do something and aren't doing it. And one on the, you know, turning 30, one approaching 50, they both did it through food.
You know, Netta, I should mention, the other thing we did on the blog this week, we did talk a little bit about this movie. And one of the things I did was I checked to see if I could successfully poach an egg according to the Julia Child method laid out in her book. I took plenty of pictures. It's on the blog. You can see how it turned out. I will only say that the movie Alien was mentioned at one point when I was looking at a picture of my poached egg. And I'll just leave it there.
Well, from the kitchens of Queens to the production studios of Senegal, Didier Awadi is a rap pioneer who combines music with his role as a social commentator. As part of Morning Edition's ongoing series on emerging cultural voices from Africa, NPR's Ophabia Quist-Arctin met up with him at his base in the Senegalese capital, Dakar.
You're listening to the distinctive sound of Senegalese rap by Didier Awadi. He's rehearsing with his band at his recording studios here in Dakar before leaving to perform in South Africa. Awadi is a big man with a big smile and a bouncing Rasta hairstyle. He pioneered local hip-hop, then a new musical genre, in this very musical city. Commentator Tijan C, editor of the website westafnews.com, met Awadi at the start of his musical career.
I think DJ Awadi is one of the young, promising African artists because he has already given evidence of his talent and what he is capable of bringing into the African musical scene.
So why did Didier Awadi choose rap?
Why did I choose hip-hop? It was just the fashion, you know. I used to be a breakdancer, and the music for breakdance was, you know, rap. So I used to listen to Grandmaster Flash, Grandmaster Melo Mel, Rapper's Delight by Sugar Hill Gang, you know. I just followed the fashion.
Then, says Awadi, he heeded some sound advice and created his band PBS, Positive Black Soul.
You know, a friend of mine told me, okay, it's good, but, you know, you're not American and you're not speaking in English, so try to be yourself. So I say, okay, I will try to do it in my own language, talk about my own realities. I'm not in the ghetto of New York. I'm in a normal, you know, city of Dakar. So let's try to talk about our own problem.
If public fanan man de fen nigga, rap be them do wak de kote chitan nigga, nyi di drop sudo yo, so nyo nyowe life chang, payback, muno mo gonde yo be mic, tanga, magisko tanga, gisko janga, gisko nyanga, kame real freestyle, kame binyu janga, kame, yes.
A translation?
Oh, this is not just a freestyle, just say that hip-hop is a real thing.
It worked. Rapping in Wolof, the dominant language here in Senegal, unleashed a whole new wave of music.
Yeah, rapping in Wolof or in Swahili or in Twi, you know, when you listen to it, this is exactly the sound that we need when we want to talk about our own reality to our own people. We need to talk a language that they can understand.
Commentator Tijan C says Awadi's lyrics strike a chord with young people all over Africa, and that it's both the message and the medium. of Fabia Quistanton, NPR News, Dakar. I'm one in a million, one in a billion. Too many already paid on the million. For every kid amount to the maximum.
Made a people they both to the minimum. 84, but they need people take a leave. Just as rappers are driven to rap, writers are driven to write, even when there's no guarantee that anyone will publish, much less read, their masterpieces. That means they have to find some way to make money. For a series from All Things Considered on how artists earn a living, Lynn Neary explores one source of income that often goes unacknowledged, ghostwriting.
When Grant Blackwood got out of the Navy in 1987, he decided he wanted to write thrillers. He knew it might be a while before he could support himself by writing. In the meantime, he was willing to chop wood, drive a limousine, whatever it took.
I did anything to put ramen noodles in my bowl and a roof over my head.
12 years later, Blackwood had his first novel published and figured he was home free. But Blackwood says becoming a successful novelist is like a series of little graduations with no guarantee of what happens afterwards.
You decide to sit down and write the book, and you do it. That's a little graduation. You finish the book. That's a little graduation. You find an agent. You find a publisher. That's another one. And so after going through all those hurdles, you kind of feel like, okay, I've made it. I've broken that last wall. But the sad truth is that you've only kind of come up against a bigger wall.
That bigger wall is getting your book sold and then selling the next one. Jenny Seiler, who also writes thrillers, got her career off to a great start when her first novel brought in a comfortable advance.
My North American advance for that book was $150,000. And so that enabled me to start writing professionally and support myself through my writing. And as time went on, my books became more literary and my advances became smaller.
Seiler's most recent advance, $20,000. And though her husband also brings in money and they live modestly, that still isn't enough to support her.
I mean, it takes me between 12 and 18 months to write a book. So I can't live on $12,000 for a year and a half.
For very long.
Yeah.
Both Seiler and Blackwood have turned to ghostwriting. For Blackwood, the decision came when the sales of his novels started dwindling. When his publisher turned down his fourth novel, Blackwood's editor promised he'd help him find work.
It wasn't more than 6 months later when he called and he said, I have this book. It's perfect for you. It's right up your alley, and we want to pay you for it. And, you know, for a writer who loves to write, being paid for something you love is a bonus.
Blackwood writes for popular thriller franchises he can't name. They give me the characters and the world they live and work in, and I do the rest, he says. But much as he likes being paid to write, he admits there are some drawbacks to being a ghostwriter.
You know, you don't get credit on the cover. You don't get royalties. It's kind of a contract deal. You write it, you give it to them, and your attachment from there financially ends, and you're not your sole master.
Blackwood has ghostwritten 5 books. Jenny Seiler is working on her first ghostwriting assignment. She got into it after she co-authored a book with art thief Miles Connor. The two worked well together, and Seiler got credit for her work. She didn't expect to do that kind of work again, but then she was offered an interesting and lucrative ghostwriting project, and she felt she couldn't turn it down. For now, Seiler has put her own writing on hold, but she plans to get back to it once this book is done. She figures she's buying herself some time in the future.
The way I look at these ghostwriting and co-writing projects is that the more financial freedom I can have to take my time with my own projects, the better off I'll be as a writer and as an artist.
Blackwood isn't working on his own writing either. This September, he has a new book coming out, a Clive Cussler novel called Spartan Gold. He's getting a co-writing credit for that, and he's pretty happy about that. Blackwood finds ghostwriting satisfying, but he knows a lot of writers wouldn't.
Because you do have to sacrifice complete control. You do have to be willing to answer to a number of different masters who are sometimes giving you contradictory input. And you have to find that middle ground, and you have to do it in a diplomatic way. And that can be tough for someone who lives their life in a creative way.
Both Blackwood and Seiler say ghostwriting may not be perfect, but getting paid to write is a pretty good life. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Now, Linda, if you're the kind of person who thinks that the works of William Shakespeare were ghostwritten, or if you're just the kind of person who really likes that kind of thing, you would have loved the 1984 British TV series Playing Shakespeare, which featured a big group of stage actors in masterclasses blending Elizabethan and modern techniques. At the time, only one of the performers was a familiar face, Ben Kingsley, who had just made the movie Gandhi. But as Bob Mondello discovered while watching the 25th anniversary DVD of Playing Shakespeare, some of those faces are instantly recognizable now.
The co-founder of London's Royal Shakespeare Company is running the show, but you'll find yourself looking at the performers sitting behind him. There's Gandhi in a sports shirt, and Agatha Christie's Inspector Poirot, younger and slenderer than you remember him. Captain Picard seems to have beamed down from an unpaid internship on the Starship Enterprise, and they're all watching a whiskerless, barely out of his 30s, Gandalf, as he's asked to work a little interpretive magic with the opening line of The Merchant of Venice.
In sooth, I know not why I am so sad.
Now, that simple line can be said in an infinite number of ways. Try it sadly.
In sooth, I know not why I am so sad.
Now try and ask what is Antonio's intention. Perhaps it's to try to explain himself.
In sooth, I know not why I am so sad.
And one more. Try and put an end to the conversation.
In sooth, I know not why I am so sad.
So on.
Ian McKellen is now a familiar movie face from Lord of the Rings, but as he was reciting that one line over and over, he was just a young classical actor starting to make a name for himself on stage. So was Judi Dench, back before she was 007's boss M. Here she's experimenting with a giggly line reading for a part where she's in breeches, not a skirt.
My father had a daughter, loved a man. As it might be, perhaps, were I a woman, I should, your lordship.
Also on hand is Patrick Stewart, already bald, and to my taste, a little too baldly declamatory in Henry V.
Why do you stay so long, my lords of France? Big Mars seems bankrupt in their beggared host, and faintly through a rusty beaver peeps.
Through a what? What on earth is he talking about? But you can sort of hear why producers thought he was spacey enough to command a starship. None of these folks is a kid, exactly. They were among the RSC's leading players at the time, old enough to know their way around a soliloquy. So it's fun to hear them talking about verse and vowels and how pronunciation helps to propel ideas. That will naturally be of most interest to actors, but there's something compelling, too, in hearing these folks place what they do in a historical perspective. Ian McKellen, for instance, arguing that it might simply not be true that modern actors are more natural than the grander performers of yesteryear. Actors, he says, are always trying to be natural. It's just that natural meant something different in the 19th century.
Everything about the world seemed to be certain. The British Empire was there and was going to last for 1,000 years, and therefore Henry Irving could stand firmly on a stage with 3,000 people and make declarations. And that was the nature of life which he could find within Shakespeare. We, with our different perceptions of the world, the fact that life is difficult, ambiguous, complicated, the British Empire doesn't exist anymore, and what is our role as a nation in the world, what is our role as people, as parents, as children, tends to direct our attention into the detail.
That is a nifty historical argument, and one that applies equally well to politicians and preachers and, dare I say it, folks who chat you up on the radio. Playing Shakespeare is, in fact, more than just a lesson in acting. It's a lesson in how the Bard of Avon knew, and all sorts of folks have since learned, that the best way to persuade is to hold the mirror up to nature. I'm Bob Mondello.
From the poetry of Shakespeare, we can fast forward to the poetry of hip-hop. Curtis Blow, one of the first superstars of rap with his mega hit The Breaks, recently turned 50. NPR's Guy Raz spoke with Curtis Blow about what he's been up to since.
Clap your hands, everybody, if you got what it takes. Because I'm Curtis Blow, and I want you to know that these are The Breaks.
This track, The Breaks, was one of the first rap mega hits. After the song's release in 1980, Curtis Blow was destined for rap's pantheon. But we were wondering, whatever happened to Curtis Blow? So to help us explain, is Curtis Blow? He's on the line with us from Burlington, Vermont, where he's on tour. Happy birthday.
Hey, thank you. Thank you very much.
So what are you up to these days?
Well, A lot of things. I am presently a licensed minister of the Gospels of my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And I'm presently on tour right now with my group, Curtis Blow and the Trinity.
Wow.
We have a new CD out. Actually, it's our sophomore CD called Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost.
So I should call you minister.
Yes, sir. Started my own ministry called the Hip-Hop Church.
Hmm. Minister Walker, when you released The Breaks as Curtis Blow back in 1980, you made history. I mean, you were the first rapper on Soul Train. Were you aware that you were part of this new sound, which would come to be called rap?
Oh, yeah, of course. My whole thing in hip-hop goes all the way back to 1972, being a b-boy break dancer myself, and then I became a DJ. It was pretty cool, you know. Hip-hop was around a long time before those first records came out. I'm just blessed, really, really fortunate to be around at 50 years old, praise God, and I feel like I have another 50 left, so watch out.
That's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia.
I'm Linda Holmes.
And I'm Neda Ulavi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia.